Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day for Movement. Whether mom's into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, you can save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with up to 50% off site-wide during Movement's Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Holly Hunter on Rooming with Frances McDormand, broadcast news, and the here and now of her new HBO series. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused, my little old podcast where I talk to amazing actors and filmmakers. And this week, yes, an amazing actor. That is definitely putting it mildly when we talk about Holly Hunter. Holly Hunter is the guest on today's show. She is, of course, I don't know, she's kind of an icon to me in terms of actors. Going back to the 80s when I came of age, I mean, films like Raising Arizona and Broadcast News, which, by the way, came out in the same year. Imagine having a year like that as an actor. Not to mention, obviously, winning the Academy Award for The Piano, getting Oscar nominated again for 13, all the way up to The Big Sick last year, where she could very well have gotten an Oscar nomination for that one. I would not have been disappointed to see that. Sadly, that didn't come to pass, but it doesn't make the work any less relevant and important. That film is available on Amazon Prime now. And she's also got a new project, a new series called Here and Now, from Alan Ball, the amazing writer, creator of such projects as 6 Feet Under and True Blood. He is back in the HBO family with this contemporary series that, you know, as the title suggests, is about sort of the world we live in today. It's about a family. Holly Hunter is the matriarch. Her husband is played by the great Tim Robbins. And it is a multicultural family, a very much a family of today that is confronting a lot of issues of today. As you would imagine, Holly is amazing. And as you would imagine from the mind of Alan Ball, it is provocative and unusual and has mystical elements, dramatic elements, comedic elements, well worth your time. It has already premiered on HBO Sunday nights, I believe. So go check out Here and Now. As you can tell by now, I'm flying solo this week. Sammy could not join me for the intro. Don't worry, she'll be back next week. She gets enough FaceTime on this show. Stop worrying about Sammy. It's always about Sammy this, Sammy that. What about me, guys? But yes, she'll be back next week, so don't worry about that. Holly Hunter, though, what a pleasure. What an honor. I think you guys know if you listen to the podcast, the ones that get me often most excited are the actors that I came of age with and kind of worshipped as a kid. And she was and is the shit. She's just amazing. And those two films I mentioned at the outset, I of course discussed with her because they were huge in my life, and they're huge in many people's lives, and they stand the test of time. Raising Arizona was kind of the breakthrough transitional film for the Coen brothers. They had debuted with Blood Simple, but then this wild and wacky comedy comes with Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter as the couple at the center, and of course John Goodman. And my gosh, if you've never seen Raising Arizona, go check it out. It is one of the great comedies of all time. And then you follow that up later in the year with Broadcast News. Whoa. I mean, Broadcast News, I've probably talked to death about on this podcast because it's really kind of a perfect movie. It's a perfect blend of drama and comedy, not to mention it's set in this great, authentic world of you know, 80s newsrooms, yet feels so current today. And that triumvirate of Holly Hunter at the center, but flanked on either side by William Hurt and Albert Brooks. I've probably seen Broadcast News 100 times, and I'll hopefully see it another 100 in my life because I just keep coming back to it. It's a classic. We talk about all of it on this in this conversation, as well as I alluded to before, her interesting past, which is that she kind of became early friends with Frances McDormand. Imagine those two
powerhouse actors living together on the streets of New York before either of them were known by anybody. And they definitely, I think if you listen to this conversation and you have a sense of Frances McDormand's personality, you can see that they are very much cut from the same cloth, forgetting the fact that they're both two of the finest actors of their generations. They are also, I don't know, tough cookies. that's what makes that minimalizes it. But like, there's something very idiosyncratic and tough about each of them, and I mean that in a flattering way. Hopefully, I'd never spoken with Holly Hunter before, and I'm so thrilled that this HBO series gave me an opportunity to get to know her a little bit. She's a smart lady, and she is continuing to just excel in her chosen profession, and she's just one of the best out there. So without any further ado, we're going to go to that conversation. You know what I'm going to say before that. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to the podcast. Go on iTunes. Give us a little love. It makes a difference. It spreads the good word. You guys have been really great, I should say. Since we've been reminding folks, I've noticed the reviews have been piling up, and the ratings have been accumulating, and I think we're there's a little groundswell brewing. I see on Twitter, I see a lot of you guys going back to the early days and listening to the 200 plus episodes in the archives. I love that. I love new people discovering Happy, Sick, and Fused. So, you know, tell your friends, review the podcast, and spread the good word. Also, I just want to mention really quickly, Black Panther is out this week. Check it out. You don't need me to say that. It's a special movie. It's a fun Marvel movie, but it also it just stands for something really important. The idea of representation, of representing everybody that makes up our world in superhero films or any kind of film is so massively important. And I think you guys, if you're pop culture junkies like myself, you're already getting a sense that this film is meaning a lot to a great many people, and it's gonna do bananas business. It's a fantastic movie. I did an interview with Chadwick Boseman, who's been on the podcast. Go check it out a couple of months back. And Michael B. Jordan, who hasn't done the podcast yet. He will one of these days. I know Mike very well. I've done a ton with him, and he's one of the good guys. Anyway, I did an interview with the two of them yesterday for MTV. We're going to post, I think that entire conversation, I think, is going to post up on like YouTube soon. So I'll tweet it out, but that's a really fun like 20-minute conversation with the two of those guys. So if you no spoilers in that, if you want to just kind of luxuriate in all things Black Panther, look out for that conversation coming at you soon. Anyway, back to the main event. Please enjoy this conversation with Holly Hunter and check out Here and Now on HBO Sunday nights. I'm very excited, to say the least, that one and only Holly Hunter is in my office. I never thought I would say that. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. I was just saying, it's been a busy year for you in a good way. We're kind of almost exactly a year ago is when Big Sick debuted at Sundance.
Yes.
I had the privilege of being there and seeing it there with that crowd. That was a moment. And then, you know, that publicity it's almost still continuing through. I mean, thankfully it's gotten some love in awards season.
I know.
People are experiencing it again on Amazon. But now here we are all over again with this great HBO series. So the freight train keeps going.
No, it's been lovely. You know, it's always a crapshoot to you know, any time that you know I do a project, anybody does a project, you have hopes for it. You know, maybe there's compromises with the script or the director or the character or, you know, whatever, or the editing or the distribution. And with the Big Sick, it, like, all the stars were aligned.
Yeah.
And from that screening at Sundance, which was just such a blast because there was such a connection that the audience felt for the movie.
Had you seen it prior to that screening?
I had.
Yeah.
But it was it was redefined.
Yeah.
Seeing it with a crowd that, you know, there are things that I do and don't like about Sundance, but the best of Sundance is their audiences, because it's a crowd of very educated, extremely turned on, you know, cinemaphiles or just great audience members who know how to participate.
Yeah.
And so that was really fun, as you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, having been through, you know, this crazy circus of show business for a number of years now and seen projects that you love come and go, sadly, sometimes. And they just, as you said, for whatever reason, it could be one of a thousand different reasons where it doesn't work out. Yeah. Do you have to kind of protect yourself at this point when you're done with the project and when you're about to kind of unveil it and sort of like not get your hopes up at this point? Are you sort of like dulled to that, or can you still get excited before you unleash something that you legitimately have pride in and you at least yourself feel like you accomplished the job and you're proud of?
I think, you know, after decades of experience, now I feel clear-eyed. I feel clear-eyed about what I've done. And I can definitely have hopes for things that don't pan out. And often things don't pan out for me and for most actors. You can do projects that don't, for whatever reason, really manifest. So hoping and expecting are two wildly different states.
Yeah.
And I still absolutely hope, but I do not expect. I try in a really educated way to not expect.
Yeah.
I experience the disappointment and then I move on.
Right.
Because it's good to go where the reality is. Oh wow, that's tough. You know, and then I'm moving on.
Let it all in and then move on to the next. Can we talk about New York for a second? You're a New Yorker. I'm born and raised in New York. It comes up a lot in this conversation, in this podcast, just because, I love New York. I love my city. And you came here pretty early on, I know.
City of dreams.
It is, for many.
City of dreams.
But it's also it's so many things, obviously. We could talk for hours. I would think about what's so great about New York. Have you lived here basically continuously since 80? Or obviously for jobs you've had to come and go, but...
No, I spent, I moved to L.A. for about 7 years in the 90s and then came back.
What's...
2000, from...
You grew up in Georgia, so... To a degree, a farm girl decided that New York City was the place to be for you, and not a passing fancy. You obviously have made your life here, raised your family here. It's not a short answer, but I'm just curious, like, what is it that you need in this city that L.A. doesn't fulfill for you, generally speaking?
Well, I think, for me, right off the bat, I there's a certain, and this has nothing to do with celebrity, this has nothing to do with being an actress even. I was completely divorced from that, but I feel invisible in New York. I feel anonymous, and always have. No matter what, I have true anonymity here, and everyone does. I mean, unless you're a superstar,
right.
Unless Woody Allen doesn't have true anonymity here. But when you go to Los Angeles, no matter who you are, you can be anyone, and people notice you because you're walking. You're not driving.
Right.
As the second that you are outside of your car, people are looking at you
like a
possible perpetrator. I mean, a predator. But something's wrong. There's something wrong with this picture. That's how I feel in Los Angeles. And in New York, I feel part of humanity. I feel part of a bigger picture. Nobody's looking at me, but I'm part of it. I'm in the stream.
Yeah.
And I that's a profound kind of connection that I feel with my fellow people.
I hear you completely because I feel like it's good for the soul. It's good for your creativity just to collide with life, and you are colliding constantly with so much in New York, I know it's some of it's the cliche thing, and I'm sure some people, LA's lovely in many ways, but I don't even drive, so I am one of those crazy people, by the way, that's like walking on the streets in LA, and I look like a crazy man,
there's sightings of you.
Yeah, no, literally. Who's that? That guy's up to no good. That can't be good. So you came here, and out of Carnegie Mellon, correct me if I'm wrong, right? And by then, obviously, you had more than the bug. You were committing yourself to this life, potentially. That's why you went to Carnegie Mellon. Where were you at, like, your first weeks in New York? How much of a struggle was it here?
It was like on drugs. I mean, it was, you know, it was, you know, New York is so intense. And in 1980, it had a different kind of intensity than it does now. It was a harsher intensity and a more kind of direct intensity. Because of now the cell phone mutes the street culture quite a bit.
Everybody's in their own.
Yeah, it mutes the feeling of the town in a way that wasn't obviously not happening in the 80s when it was a harder city. It was a more scary city. But I felt like it was crack cocaine or something. I mean, I felt like I didn't sleep for 2 weeks. When I got here, I was so high from absorbing the direct hits of energy of the city, of the people, that I just couldn't believe it. And then I think I crashed and, you know, I crashed and burned and slept, you know, and was happy that I lived in New York because I had had that experience as a visitor. But you don't have any place to let down as a visitor. So it was actually easier for me to live here because then I could go back to my house and kind of recover from what the city gave me, which, you know, is, as you know, I mean, it's just a really, and I love, that's what I love. I love the intensity.
What did your parents make of your early passion for acting and your decision to go with Carnegie Mellon and then to New York? Were they supportive? Were they like, obviously acting, the arts was not in your family, it's safe to say, right?
No, it's a mystery. I don't really, I've gone to years of therapy, darling, and I still cannot put two and two together and come up with four about why my parents were so, like, enthusiastic, serious, nurturing, financially utterly supportive, but they were.
What did
they? Not that they didn't know anything about it, but it was something that it seemed like I you know, I had a knack for. I really liked it, you know. And so they footed the bill. But then when I got to New York, I was on my own, which was right and good. And
doing theater mostly here, I would think.
In those days, you could live in Manhattan and be a waitress. You might have a couple of roommates, but you could wait tables or you could do temp work. And I did, you know, various things, you know, those things. And I remember there was this nightclub, this jazz club on 70th and basically Amsterdam, called the Grand Finale.
Oh, wow. That's literally like a block away from where I grew up. I grew up on West 70th Street.
Well, do you remember the Grand Finale?
I don't. I can't. I don't know.
It was, you know, not far from Cafe Lux.
Luxembourg, yeah,
and,
sure.
And so I was their bookkeeper. they were high. But anyway.
Was there anything you had a great aptitude to in any of these odd jobs that you felt like was a fallback? Or was it clear that if acting was going to work out, we were going to have to seriously reevaluate some life decisions and figure stuff out?
I was going to have to some reevaluation. Okay. Totally. Like no plan B. I mean, I had taken shorthand. You know, I was a good typist. I mean, secretarial work.
Right.
I wasn't bad at.
Okay. I don't know if that would have made for a good podcast.
I was a good waitress, but I didn't really enjoy waiting.
Right.
But it was all, you know, it was all cool because I could live in New York and do those things and continue to audition for stuff.
And not only did you get that opportunity, but you had what seems to be, like, short of the infamous, like, Dustin Hoffman, Gene Hackman roommate situation, the best acting roommate situation I could ever imagine, which is you and Frances McDormand. That amount of talent in that 500 square feet, whatever you had, is kind of insane to think of. Did you guys hit it off from the start?
Yeah. Yeah, we did. Our boyfriends hit it off. Our boyfriends were best friends. And I was living in New York with my boyfriend, Grzegorz. And he was best friends with Vytautas, who was going to Yale. And Grzegorz said, hey, let's go visit, you know, Vietz. And and Vietz's girlfriend was Fran. So we met, you know, hanging out with Vietz and Grzegorz. And then we said we were living up in the North Bronx at that time. And we said, come, after they graduated, come move to the North Bronx. We've got this little enclave. It's so great. You know, it was really affordable, huge spaces,
sure.
Lots of sunlight, you know, very Irish Latino neighborhood.
Yep.
And end of the D train, 205th Street, at the end of the D line. Great. So, and then we both break up with our boyfriends after a period of time.
Sure.
And then we had an extra apartment. So I said, you know, move in with, come to my house because my apartment was bigger than Fran's. So.
Amazing.
Then we, yeah.
And did she obviously ended up making a life with Joel Cohen. So you guys were all good friends, obviously. I mean, we'll get to Raising Arizona, but even before that, was there, like, I'm curious, like what was the, where was everybody at in their lives? Was everybody kind of like on the same level in terms of like struggling and trying to like figure out that like the quote unquote big break, or were you all getting by? And was like, was Ethan there? Was Sam Raimi in the mix? I'm just curious to like set the scene for me a little bit of that group.
Well, so Fran and I were up in the North Bronx. Both of us busted up with our bows, and then we had this apartment together, and I was doing a Broadway show, and Fran was doing theater around town too, and Joel and Ethan came and saw me in this play, and they said, "Hey, you know, we're casting this movie, Blood Simple. You know, you'd be so cool. It'd be so great to work with you." And I said, "You know, I'm leaving this show for another play, and I'm signed on to do that play. I'm not going to be available, but my roommate."
Who happens to be one of the best actors ever to walk earth? Would be pretty good.
Maybe you guys should meet my roommate. And so they met Fran, and Fran did Blood Simple, and then Joel started hanging around with us in the Bronx, and then you know we had enough of the Bronx, and then we moved into the West Village on Morton and Hudson, and right above Henrietta. What is the name of that bar? And it's still around, but it changed locations. Not Henrietta Hudson. Anyway, we lived above this lesbian bar, and Joel, you know, and then eventually Fran left, and Joel and she moved in together on the Upper West Side, and then you know, but we were all like buddies, and then we all rented a house together in Silver Lake. And that was with Sam Raimi and Scott Spiegel. And they were writing Evil Dead 2 at the time on the front porch. It was L.A. living, you know.
Crazy.
You could live on the front porch and like write all day and like drink coffee and switch to, you know, wine and smoke
Sounds
cigarettes
like a good life.
All day. So we all were smoking cigarettes, lots of packs in Silver Lake. And I was looking for work. And, I mean, we were all just kind of hanging out in L.A. It was my first real experience of Los Angeles.
Were you kicking yourself by the time Blood Simple came out when you saw?
No, Fran was brilliant.
Yeah,
Fran was great. So no, it wasn't like that. I mean, it just didn't. I don't know. It wasn't that kind of a deal. And so then you know, Joel and Ethan wrote Raising Arizona, and when we were in Silver Lake, they said, "Read this. We wrote this part for you. What do you think?" And they had a little part for Fran, so Fran and me were getting to play a few scenes together, and the part was amazing, and it was kind of my first, you know, leading feature film role. But it was kind of
Then. Like, in retrospect, it's like you could chart it, but yeah.
I mean, it was very, you know, we had boyfriends and girlfriends who were coming and going, and I don't know. People were just making stuff.
Yeah.
You know, scripts were, you know, it was very unselfconscious and not really struggling. It wasn't struggling. I don't know. It just never felt like, I never felt like I was desperate times, desperate measures, you know, in my acting career. Yeah. Never felt that particular thing.
It's a lucky thing, because probably many, and maybe that's youth, or maybe that's just not.
I think it's a combination of youth and whatever's in my DNA, but that was not a color that was in my palette, really. So, yeah.
Were you guys on the same page in terms of like the style of Raising Arizona? I mean,
I didn't know what style was.
Well, it's such a different movie. It's funny. Like if you look now back at like their work, Blood Simple and Raising Arizona are two of kind of the motifs that they've kind of returned to in different ways. And yes, that's of their body of work. But at the time, Raising Arizona was like pretty remarkably different from the tone of Blood Simple.
Totally.
And it demanded clearly a heightened style of acting, it would seem to me, by what you and Nick were doing and what John Goodman was doing. And I'm just
totally.
I'm just curious. Like,
but I was coming from the theater. Yeah. So lots of things in the theater are heightened. You know, I mean, like you can often play tonally slightly elevated, you know, slightly off the ground in plays. That's not unusual.
Right.
I mean, I'd spent 4 years at Carnegie studying theater and acting. You know, I was in this kind of more absurdist, like anything goes kind of thing. And so had Fran, you know, at Yale. I mean, you're in that really intense, you know, undiluted soup that is an acting conservatory. And then you go out and you start doing movies, and they've got a movie where the tone is a little lifted. It's pretty easy.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not even thinking about it.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it was harder for me to tone it down. And, you know, still can be.
I mean, when you look back at that year, it's absurd to think that, like, you know, two of my favorite films on the planet came out from you that year. You know, Jim Brooks then follows that up with Broadcast News, which I always say, you know, when people ask me like what my favorite movie is or what's a perfect movie, that's pretty much at the top of my list.
Yeah.
It's just, and I'm not alone in that, as you well know. It stands the test of time. It works on just so many different levels.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, it's a crazy movie.
It's crazy and so watchable, and just there's so much to enjoy out of it. Jim Brooks is a character. He's a genius, but
yeah.
But also, like, I mean, I don't even know. I've only talked to him, I think, a couple times over the years. But he seems like very affable, but a perfectionist, or maybe very neurotic in a very charming way. I'm just curious. Seemingly different from any other filmmaker, and I know you've talked. I've heard you say that that was a tough experience. It was a trying experience.
No, not for me. For Jim.
Oh, really?
But for me, at the end of it, I was like, wow, buddy, wow, that was so much fun. And he was like, was it?
Pulling his hair out.
Oh, shit. I had so much. It was so much fun for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
When you think back to that, I mean, it's like one of the most quotable films of all time, and there are so many iconic scenes. Is there a scene that jumps out at you as that kind of embodies that experience that that you return to?
No, you know, I mean, doing a movie, you know, I'm so cognizant when I'm watching a movie of what was happening on that day.
Right.
You know, where I was. Oh, I had a nap that day. I never nap. You know, I mean, there are all these kind of like backlog channels that are operational when I'm seeing movies. I mean, the experience of working with Albert, who's genuinely unbelievably funny. You know, that was incredible to discover the humor of Albert during rehearsals. And Albert and I rehearsed together a ton, a lot. And we got to know each other and kind of love each other before the movie ever began. Mm. And I guess, you know, there's a thing that Jim had as a director, which was you could become his muse, and that's you know, at the age of approaching 60, now I know that's highly unusual.
Right.
It's highly unusual in a way for a director to give him or herself over to that kind of
The vessel through which he's telling a story.
Yes. And also just attention combined with love, you know. And you know, Jane Campion had that too. It just like that I just felt that I was in a spotlight of
right.
of love, and kind of to be the adored one, to be one who was adored.
Yeah.
So that the work comes out of that filter, that just is a really rare quality, because both Jim Brooks and Jane Campion have very healthy egos.
Right.
But so it's a matter of not turning over their ego. They don't turn their ego over to you.
Yeah.
It's not slavish or obsequious in any way. It's just empowering of the actor. And I mean, and as time goes on, I find that directors who give actors love, who just give them love, that is in and of itself is a potent exchange
yeah.
on a movie set, to have a director go, you know, I just love you. I love you. You know, that alone can be so cool.
It must also be fascinating to a couple of the people you've talked about. You've had the opportunity to kind of go back to years later, Jane Campion, you worked with again on Top of the Lake.
Yeah.
It took a while, but you and the Coens reteamed for O Brother, Where Art Thou? Sadly, you and Jim haven't worked together since he hasn't made that many movies.
Right. Jim is a different kind of filmmaker. I mean, you know, if you just think about, like, the years that he put into preparing for Broadcast News.
Right.
I mean, he prepared for years. And it shows, because we are still talking about that movie in a current kind of way. Because it's so present, you know, it's so felt now,
yeah,
with an immediacy, and it's very modern. It still feels modern.
You probably inspired a generation of journalists.
Totally,
I'm sure people come up to you all the time.
Well, that's the best that I've ever been treated by. You know, reporters. I mean, you know, the whole out of my hand.
Right.
Feed, you know.
The one thing I want to mention that came out of a couple years after that is you worked with Steven Spielberg on a film that I really adore. Always is a very sweet, unabashed, super romantic film that I don't know. I just think of you in John Goodman's arms in that film, just enveloped that kind of like wonderful visual. What do you think of when you think of Always? What do you
well,
think?
Well, I you know. Steven is a revelation. He's a one-off also, because he has continued, you know, Steven's desire, his hunger to tell stories is absolutely happening now. He has a desire to explore his own psyche, you know, in mirrored by these different projects that he does,
yeah.
kind of unfolding himself. It feels very personal to me what Steven is still able to offer up, and his intuitive skills are incredible. I mean, where he was putting the camera in the post was so fresh and exciting and vibrant to me,
yeah.
And very surprising. You know, he was very nervy with his camera.
Yeah, it almost had like that kind of like that Paul Greengrass, like handheld kind of like you are there verite kind of
yeah,
vibe.
Yeah, and it would be in like odd places, and then the actors would come home to it. I mean,
right.
it was very fresh and exciting.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know if I watched the Spielberg doc. Maybe you were a part of it. I can't remember.
I just watched it. I just watched it.
It's amazing. It's like, I mean, look.
It's a revelation.
You see the posters on my wall. You get a sense of sort of my age and like where I grew up. And like he's obviously for many and most the filmmaker of our times.
Right.
And yet still watching that documentary, I've said this before, I feel like, oh my God, I think I underrated him. That's possible. Like he's the filmmaker of my life. Yet if you look at that, he is just preternaturally skilled and can do, it seems, anything with a camera.
Yes. Yes, but it's not just that he's like handy with the camera. It's like he has an emotional intuition that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
It's just extraordinary. And when I found out that, you know, when I went, oh yeah, of course, E.T. is shot through the prism of divorce. I'd never looked at it as a reaction, kind of a childhood reaction to divorce.
Yeah.
Broke my heart. It re-broke my heart to and Saving Private Ryan and just to see, you know, saving the first 20 minutes of see some footage from that first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan is like nobody's ever going to do that.
Yeah.
No one is ever going to do that. Anybody else who would do that would make it look like pornography, violent pornography or porn violence. I mean, in Stephen's hands, it was just not that. It was an amazing, you know, unforgettable,
yeah,
visceral experience in the theater.
We've mentioned Jane Campion a couple times, and I mean, just looking back at the success of The Piano in every respect, it kind of feels to me like a miracle in a way. Again, we talked about how Big Sick, again, we started there, right? Like how it just sort of like everything went right, and that very rarely,
yes,
happens. The same way, I think you can make the argument about The Piano. Again, like looking at the times we're living in now, would The Piano be what it was today in this strange multiplex superhero laden climate? Is there room for a piano at the box office? I don't know.
I'd say yes.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you feel that.
I think so.
So, but at the time, was it?
I mean, look at Moonlight.
That's true.
Look at Call Me by Your Name.
Yeah.
I mean, these beautiful movies that surface and get accolades and get acknowledgement.
No, that's fair. Yeah. At the time, did it feel like? Again, you talked a little bit about that collaboration with Jane, but the way it cut through and the way it sort of became a cultural moment, was that surprising at the time?
Shock! Totally shocking. Yeah, there was no way that I could possibly have. I remember saying, I don't think anybody's going to see this movie, but the few people who do are going to love it.
Right.
You know, they will fall in love with the movie. You know, they will be intoxicated by it. But I totally thought that no one would see the movie.
Then it's you and Anna Paquin on a stage winning Oscars. It's crazy. It's a crazy story. And it struck me like, that's not a one-off. You've worked with a lot of young performers over the years. I don't know if it's disproportionate.
Evan Rachel Wood.
Yeah, you think of 13, obviously. Is that something that – do you feed off of that a little bit when it's someone that is maybe relying a little bit more on instinct, a little less trained? I mean, I even think of something in a different way, like The Big Sick. I wouldn't equate, you know, Kumail with like a child performer, but he comes from a different background, right? He doesn't have the body of acting work.
He is a child.
He's a child at heart. but I, you know what I mean? I mean, like, I would hope and think at its best, you know, I think I talked to Willem Dafoe about this on the Florida Project. Like, he worked with performers of different kind of experience. When it works at its best, there's a tangible energy, hopefully, that is on the screen. And have you found that to be the case? Not something like 13, was that the case, for instance, working with Evan and Nikki?
Well, I mean, working with Anna was, you know, that was kismet. That was that was chemistry. That was an undeniable hookup,
yeah,
that Anna and I had for each other. It was just undeniable and lucky as hell. And I loved Anna. And I think, yeah, I could say she loved me. I mean, I certainly felt loved by her. She was 9 at this incredibly magical, tender age, But nevertheless, she was a nine-year-old who hooked up with me. And we trusted each other, and I really got to know her, and got to know her, particularly her father. It was just very shimmering. It was a shimmering experience to have that relationship with her that was recorded, because it was real. I mean, it was just a real love.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something that I do not take for granted, and it certainly does not always happen. And you can totally do a movie and not have chemistry with people. And maybe it can even look like you might if the script is particularly wonderful. But that was something that was just a gift to me. You know, in my life, that was a gift to have Anna. And she's proven herself an ungodly talented actress who is an original. She has an original energy about her and mystery about her, you know, to this day. And that is something that I feel so thrilled for her, that she was able to keep that intact from child to woman as an actress.
Have you compared Alan Ball notes with her? She's a veteran of the Alan Ball experience, and you're obviously not knee-deep. You probably filmed, I would think, the whole first season. But
well, sometimes, you know, like Alan said to me one day, he said, yeah, it's so weird. I saw you across the set, and I thought you were Anna. And
wow.
That's, you know, not that Anna and I look unbelievably alike, but there is something, you know, of the essence that even though we're really different, but there is a familial thing.
Yeah. It's funny, like, looking at your filmography, you know, you were doing TV before it was cool to do TV. You know, you were doing, like, when you were experiencing a tremendous amount of success in film, you chose to do some television movies, which were very well received. They're great movies in their own right. But at the time, that was more of the anomaly. Was that something that felt like a risk or something odd that your representatives thought was a strange choice? Or was it just sort of like you were going where the material was?
I don't know. I think because I came from theater, that did not really have it wasn't a risk. I wasn't thinking of it as a risk. Maybe if I'd moved to Los Angeles and it had been, you know, schooled more in what you do, what you don't do. But I was in New York, and that does make that through that filter, things are valued differently. For me, those were great parts. It was great to go from broadcast news to Roe versus Wade felt natural to me. I mean, it was NBC. Who cares? I mean, this is a great part. I believe in this project. I'm pro-choice. Yeah.
Sure.
You know, so in the same with After the Piano, I did, the Positively True Adventures of the Alleged Texas Cheerleader Murdering Mom, and it was with the great Michael Ritchie.
Right.
So I was like, wow, he's a legend.
Yeah.
I love Bad News Bears, mm-hmm. Downhill Racer.
Totally.
The candidate. I mean, you know, Michael's smile. The Michael's movies go on and on in terms of, you know, brilliance. So I was like, wow, this is the next great step.
Do you chase filmmakers as much as you chase scripts? Like, I think it was something like Crash. Cronenberg is someone that I have great reverence for. Was that someone that you were like?
I chased Cronenberg.
Did you?
I did chase David for work. And I did it, you know, very diplomatically and very tastefully. But I pursued him.
And he relented.
He relented.
He seems like, you know, for as deliciously, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, deliciously fucked up as his materials can often seem, a very kind of almost zen presence.
Fun guy.
Yeah.
Just fun. Fun-loving, you know, very mischievous and fun person to hang out with.
Probably good to offset subject matter like Crash with someone that's able to giggle a little bit.
He can totally giggle.
Coens can too, from what I gather.
Yes, they can. But I love and adore Cronenberg. He's a great auteur, and his movies are, you know, they are his.
Yeah.
they belong to no one else.
Absolutely.
And his humor just is, you know, I love how his humor infiltrates his films. I find myself yucking it up through all of his movies except for, you know, Dead Ringers. I did not. That was not funny.
That's a tough one.
It was brilliant.
Yes.
And, you know, Jeremy Irons, he should have 2 Academy Awards for that. But, yeah, I think he's one of the more amusing filmmakers to me.
Yeah.
Because it's a set up against something so grotesque and so macabre and frightening and nightmarish that he can, I don't know what that infusion, how he does that.
Right. It reminds me, I've been talking a lot of the podcast about, obviously, a lot of the great films that have come out in the recent months, and that makes me think of something like, I don't even seen Phantom Thread yet, but like that was, I felt like a surprising, like, oh, this is actually a black comedy, and I kind of love it. Like, I think I laughed during Phantom Thread as much as I did at anything short of Big Sick maybe last year. And I kind of love that about Paul Thomas Anderson's work.
He's a master as well.
We've talked about a lot of notable filmmakers. Do you feel like there must be a few that have gotten away that still are on that list of ones that were the ones that you pursued that it didn't work out for whatever reasons that.
Well, you want me to talk to you about regrets?
Yeah. I mean,
I'm not confessional like that.
Okay. I'm trying to offer you a free therapy session.
I'm not that kind of girl.
We'll keep it positive. So here and now, a positive experience.
Yes, extremely.
So, we talked a little bit about Alan Ball. I saw the first episode this morning. Tim Robbins, an amazing ensemble in this. And it, as the title kind of reveals, it very much feels about the here and now that we're living in.
Yeah.
I mean, it, you know, without revealing too much, like the Tim's character is going through, safe to say, a midlife crisis, has a speech that almost feels like a speech many people could give in 2018. It feels like a, I don't know, speaking to something in the moment.
You know, a zeitgeist moment. But I think that, you know, Alan has the moxie. You know, he's got the daring to, you know, this television series is perched on the precipice of crisis, you know, full-blown crisis. This family is going through each, in a way, their individual crisis of everything, of belief in themselves, of where they are in the world, who they think they are versus who they really are. I mean, you know, Alan has approached this project extremely ambitiously, and he has the ability to unfold, you know, to peel. I mean, he's a great saga-ist.
Mm-hmm.
And he carries these extremely complicated people in a way more complicated than you could have in a film because you only have an hour and a half or 2 hours. And he goes, no, I'm going for the big kahuna.
Yeah.
So
juggling many characters. And it feels like, honestly, seeing that just the first episode, I feel like I'm not even sure what, and I mean this again in a positive way, I'm not sure what this show is yet. Like, I'm not sure where any of these characters are going.
He takes the time that the great Alan Ball takes the time that the great Alan Ball takes, and he gets to have that kind of canvas.
Yeah.
And to shoot it filled with, like, unbelievable complexity and people who are grandly flawed and not necessarily, I like her. They're not the easiest people.
Right.
But they are fascinating people. Why are they the way that they are? Are we going to find out? And what are they going to do next? And, you know, I just think that I so love delving into it, being, you know, getting the opportunity to take that kind of dive.
Yeah.
Because with Alan, it's going to be a deep dive. And he does it with so many, the number of engagements that he makes with his characters is really, it's mighty.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, you know, we started by talking about this great kind of full circle year you've had from Big Sick to here and now. And I've heard you talk about before coming out of your previous series might have been the, if there was a difficult time, kind of a, like a moment you, where you had to kind of take stock of sort of like your place in the industry, that might have been the time in terms of like, okay.
You mean after that series?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I was like, wow.
So where are we at today with this great success of The Big Sick, which had this like amazing run that continues? You have this great HBO show that's just starting. I mean, do you, I don't know, are you ambitious as an actor where you're like, there are things I still need and want to do? Or are you noticing like, I have a different new niche that I fit into, the scripts are getting better? Or is it all just cyclical and like, this year will be good, next year might not be so good, but don't worry, 2 years ahead might be a good year. I mean, what's the attitude about sort of where you're at now?
Well, I mean, there's a natural ebb and flow to anyone's career. And that just happens, maybe, unless you're Tom Cruise. I mean, right. and even Tom has had some ebbs and flows.
Sure.
But nevertheless, he manages to remain on the crest of like a superstardom. I mean, I don't know if you saw Made in America, but I thought it was really the Doug Liman. I thought it was really fun, great.
Yeah.
Cruise was great.
Yeah.
I mean, he's still putting it out there. But with the rest of us more lowly, you know, mortals, you know, there are definite ebbs and flows. And I can kind of take my own temperature at this point in my life and go, yeah, I love to act. I mean, I love the expression. I love the exchange with my fellow actors and with a director. If, you know, but the directors, I mean, it's all a little bit of a crapshoot, but you know, I come with an extended, you know, palm, an open palm.
Right.
And love doing that.
It's interesting because I'm thinking about it like, I would think right now the directors that are kind of coming of age, that are kind of like my age. I'm 41, so I was, you know, I was 11 when I saw Raising Arizona and Broadcast News, and as you know, you can tell those stuck with me in a profound way. Are you finding that kind of like you're getting kind of a? Not, I feel like you've always been in favor and always been acknowledged, but like the people that are making films now, there's kind of like a different generation now that like remembers and loves you from that work and wants to utilize you in a different way.
Well, I mean, Showalter, you know, Mike Showalter from Big Sick, you know, is a much younger guy than me. And once again, that was a very special collaboration that I had with him. It was based on a real trust, effortless trust, that I had in Mike. I just trusted him, and so did we all. You know, that was just one, the language was effortless between all of us, and that we all had with Mike. It was like Mike is our leader. If Mike says he got it, then he got it. By God, he got it.
Well, it's also like, you know, you go back to that Raising Arizona conversation. It's like you were all making the same movie. You all, you know, you and Nick Cage were making the same movie. If you weren't, that would have looked like a strange...
Would have been tough.
A tough thing. And in the same way, I feel like The Big Sick...
We were all making the same movie.
If you're talking about tone, if you're talking about whatever the word is...
Tone is crucial. Tone is really crucial.
And where are you at in terms of like, you know, you look at a thing like Batman versus Superman. Is that something it's like, you know what? It's a nice offer. It's a studio film. It's a good...
Totally.
And that's fine. There's nothing like... Why should we thumb our nose at
things? You'd be talking to another actor.
Right.
I don't feel that way. I just don't. I mean, I've worked in my life for lots of different reasons.
Sure.
And Batman versus Superman was an adventure all on its own. You know, I mean, it was like nothing I'd ever done before. I don't know if you know Zack Snyder, but he's like a totally adorable guy.
Yeah.
Who... was kind of a lovely Peter Pan kind of energy, leading the massive troops, you know, that in Detroit, which was also a total adventure to be in Detroit at this time in its life.
Sure.
So there were lots of upsides, and not only that, but it was like, okay, if I do this movie, they're going to see me in this movie. This movie is going to be seen.
And it was.
And I do movies where they don't see the light of day,
right?
Because things happen. Things happen along the way. It's like in the old West, you know, when it's like, oh, you know, Uncle Jeb is gonna come see us, you know, and it was like, you know, by the grace of God, maybe I'll get there by supper tomorrow night because he's going to be riding horses through the mountain pass, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's winter. Maybe he runs out of food. I mean, whatever.
That's the journey.
That's kind of the journey of making especially an independent movie.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the climate is not, it's harsh.
It's to say the least. I was just at Sundance and it's like that environment has changed. And I was just thinking as I was watching it, for good or for bad, like 80% of these films are not going to be seen in a theater. They're going to be seen and maybe more people will see them.
They're festival movies.
But on the other hand, they're going to go on Netflix and Amazon, and maybe more people will see them that way. And so, you know, is it good or bad? It's beyond that.
Or maybe they'll go on Netflix and Amazon and just fall into the black pit of the black hole.
I was trying to keep it positive.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
I went into the
independent hole, the ditch.
Well, you've been through it, so I get it. And the last thing on kind of like the blockbuster side of things I do want to mention is Incredibles 2, which I'm extremely excited about.
Yeah, me too.
How often does a child just recognize you from your voice?
Tons. I get, yes. If I want to really be anonymous, I don't talk.
Well, you have the advantage of being able to do accents, but I assume that gets old at Starbucks. You don't want to always have to put on a different voice.
Yes. Oh, Penny. Jennifer.
Yes. Don't trust that woman that's drinking the latte with Jennifer on it. That could be Holly Hunter, guys. honestly, it's been a real, real treat. As you can tell, I'm a big admirer of your work, and
Thank you.
I'm so thrilled that you're more than going strong. The Big Sick is, if people have not checked it out, Kumail was here, so we've given it a lot of love. We'll continue to. But now, Here and Now on HBO, just starting up right now. 10 episodes? How many are we starting?
10? 10.
Nice. Okay, so 10. As I said, it's an amazing ensemble, but it's also from the great mind of Alan Ball, so trust in that. Holly, it's been a pleasure, truly.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.